Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of lectures given by Father John Hardin in Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father Hardin is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father speaks on the subject, The Conduct of Morality in Hinduism. Father Hardin.
We want to take up today first the subject of conduct or morality in Hinduism, as part of which we will see the caste system, and then as far as we can get, Hindu ritual and worship. As commonly understood, Hinduism has three aspects of conduct that are characteristic. The names are spelled on the board: Dharma, Varna, and Ashrama. Briefly identified, Dharma may be identified as the established order. It is sometimes used as synonymous for religion. Actually, it is the order somehow established in the universe to which every human being, in this case every Hindu, ought to conform. Varna is the Sanskrit term for caste, S-T-E, of course. And an ashrama is a stage, or the plural ashramas, the stages of life through which, ideally, a Hindu ought to pass. Each of these has been profoundly influential in shaping Hindu life, because while the underpinnings that we saw yesterday, namely the doctrine such as it is, with all its complexities and, by our standards, contradictions, it is really Hindu conduct that makes Hinduism. Among these, as we shall see, Varna, or caste, is in practice the most important. It, however, is only a part of the larger conspectus of Hindu ethics, namely Dharma. And, in terms of the whole of a man's program, the ashramas through which he passes are what should shape his moral conduct. First, then, Dharma. The basic idea is ethical conduct based on prescriptions handed down by virtuous ancestors. Each of three terms is significant. It pertains, therefore, to ethical conduct rather than to internal belief. This conduct is based on prescriptions, on mandates, therefore, that are somehow morally obligating. And the knowledge of what these norms of conduct are is derived from ancestors, and not just any ancestors, but one's virtuous and morally abiding ancestors. Its purpose, the purpose of Dharma, or sometimes Dharma, is to guide a man through life on his personal, social, and religious level according to an established order. The Hindu does not examine too closely what the foundations of that order are, who ultimately determined it, or even too much refine its prescriptions, For him it is mainly to believe and obey according to that belief. Basically, Dharma has as its function to put people first negatively on their guard and positively to give them certain ideals or principles to abide by. The negative aspect of Dharma can be easily identified, and we will immediately recognize something in our own scriptures. Its function is to protect people against the three great pitfalls of human nature. The three great enemies to moral human conduct. And they are, again, still on the board, kama, which is lust, lobha, which is covetousness, and krodha, which is anger. And a moment's reflection will tell us that's plenty. In fact, that's about all there is. Lust, therefore, which somehow synthesizes all the desires for pleasure, but symbolized in the pleasure for sexual experience. That's kama. And by the way, you may know one of the classic works, the Kama Sutra, which I don't commend to your reading, it is not on your bibliography list, is about 300 pages of carefully studied ways of increasing lustful pleasure. Well, the law-abiding Hindu is practicing Dharma insofar as he controls kama, namely lust, in all of its manifestations. The internal drive to pleasure, symbolized in the sexual drive called lust. Lobha, which technically refers to avarice or covetousness, really synthesizes or symbolizes all the desires of acquisition. In other words, to get what a person does not have. And how many drives we have in that direction, because of the nature of things. Each of us has so little, and there is so much around to want. Lobha, therefore, the urge to possess, to acquire what one does not have, needs control. And finally, krodha, anger, which in turn symbolizes or synthesizes all the pent-up instinct to overcome anything that stands in the way of either kama or lobha. Anything that stands in the way is the instinct to krodha, which is to anger, to remove, to destroy whatever would stand between me and either my internal desires or the urge to acquire what I do not have. Its negative side is elaborated, and our own Jesuit teachers, for example, in Indian colleges, have no trouble, really, in interweaving this triad into the Christian ethic. You will find things that are almost verbatim, either in our scriptures or in our standard books of morals. But more positively, Dharma seeks to enjoin a variety of virtue. Now, the degree of a person's practicing this virtue is, of course, determined by how much grace he has and how generous he is. But the panoply of virtues prescribed for the Hindu is enough to make a saint of a Christian. If you have your copies of the Hindu scriptures, may I ask you to turn to page 311, where we have the Hindu Decalogue. And like our own Decalogue in the Old Testament, it begins where Decalogues should begin, namely with man's responsibility to the origin of his being, and only then the corresponding responsibilities that he has for the practice of moral virtue. In other words, our own Decalogue, with its first three commandments, I am the Lord thy God, then not to use the name of the Lord in vain, then to keep holy the Sabbath day, corresponding to religion, to man's duty towards God, then the seven last commandments, having to do with man's responsibility in the moral order, are not verbatim, of course. But the pattern is here. Let's read the first four verses having to do with man's responsibility to Brahman. Actually, they are verses 17 through 20. Let me read. Up to this point, Krishna has been describing the varieties of beings in the world, some perishable, some imperishable. Then he says, but there is yet another person, the All-Sublime, surnamed the All-Highest Self. The three worlds he enters and pervades, sustaining them, the Lord, who passes not away. Since I transcend the perishable and am more exalted than the imperishable self, the Atman within man, so am I extolled in common as in Vedic speech, as the person all sublime. Now the first duty. Whoever knows me, unconfused, as the person all sublime, knows all, and knowing all communes with me, with all his being, all his love. And so have I at last revealed this most mysterious doctrine. Let a man understand it, for then he'll be a man who truly understands his life's work done. So far religion, so far corresponding to the first three mandates of the Decalogue. Then the Blessed Lord said, fearless and pure in heart, steadfast in the exercise of wisdom, restrained and open-handed, performing sacrifice, intent on studying holy writ, ascetic and upright. Actually, the first verse of chapter 16 still belongs to the part having to do with religion, but already begins to span the moral order. Then the formal moral commandment. None hurting, the famous ahimsa of Hinduism. Truthful, from anger free, renouncing all, at peace, averse to calumny, compassionate to all existing beings, free from nagging greed, gentle, modest, never fickle, ardent, patient, enduring, pure, not treacherous nor arrogant, such is the man who is born to inherit a godly destiny. No wonder Hinduism has so much, if only it is understood, on which Christianity can build. So much then for Dharma in its broadest general theoretical perspective. The average Hindu, while respecting and, according to his lights and abilities, practicing Dharma, is actually ensured that he will practice this kind of moral conduct in virtue of the caste or varna to which he belongs. Varna in Sanskrit means color, and as we shall see in a moment, the first scripture tradition on the main four castes divided the human race according to its four major colors, and as you would expect, the Brahmins was white. First, something that characterizes all the castes, and then something that is characteristic of each one singly. Before we analyze that, let's see what those castes are. Their names are in the right top corner. Brahmin, which your author, the translator here, has Brahman, B-R-A, with a line above it to distinguish from Brahman. Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. What are the features of all the four castes? They are a closed social group based, as we would expect, on heredity. You belong to the caste in which you are born, and you belong to it because you were born in it. A second feature, each caste has an independent organization, a head, a council, that periodically meets to pass judgments or interpret the law. Thirdly, each caste has common festivals, common usages, has certain gods that it prefers, whom it specially worships. And among the customs that characterize each caste or subcaste are especially customs having to do with food and marriage. Fourthly, members of the caste generally belong to the same profession or to the same kind of trade or occupation that is related to that profession. Thus, carpenters, tillers of the soil, merchants, and so on. And finally, each caste has, and this is part of Vedic law, it has the authority to impose penalties. As you know, there's no problem really, except in theory, to pass laws. The real problem is to enforce them. An authority, genuine authority, is recognized when it can enforce what it commands. It has this kind of authority, therefore, punitive authority, of which the worst penalty is the exclusion from the caste. To be an outcast is a term found in Hinduism 1,000 years before Christ. Now, this caste system looked at from the outside by us who don't belong to the caste system, who are not Hindus, what are we to make of it? What interpretation can we put upon it? How do the Hindus understand it? What are the implications of belonging to each successive caste? Some say with a fair degree of accuracy that Hinduism is nothing but the caste system built on the Vedas. Now, the relevance of that statement is not that it describes the caste system, but that it indicates how profoundly, and the word is too weak, how quintessentially stratification, division, in the deepest sense of that word, racism, is part and parcel of Hinduism. Its essence is division, is casteism. Where do the Hindus find Vedic or scriptural authorization for believing in the caste system? If you will turn again in Zeno's Hindu scriptures, there are two foundations in Vedic literature for the caste system. Now, as we read this, we feel, well, isn't that reading something into the text? Well, maybe it is, but that's where tradition comes in. The first text occurs in the Rig Veda, which, as you know, is the principal Veda. It occurs in the 10th book in the 90th section. And verses 11 and 12 are the ones where the caste system is mainly found. Zahir, I notice, translates with a capital man, calling him primal man, where other translators speak of him as supreme being. Pages 8 and 9, Rig Veda, 10th chapter, the 90th section. When they divided primal man, other translators prefer supreme being, into how many parts did they divide him? What was his mouth? What his arms? What are his thighs called? What his feet? Mouth, by anticipation, refers to the first caste, arms to the second, thighs to the third, feet to the fourth. The Brahman, or other translators, the Brahmin, was his mouth. The arms were made the prince. His thighs, the common people, and from his feet, the serf was born. Zahir took the liberty of translating the Sanskrit terms, which are the formal names for these castes. So he has Brahman, others prefer Brahmin. Where he has prince, others prefer the Sanskrit Kshatriya, prince as one who leads an army. Where he has common people, the Sanskrit term is Vaishya, and where he has serf, the technical name for the caste is Shudra, often spelled with an S, a dot beneath it, in Sanskrit, S with a dot beneath it, is pronounced as SH. We will pick up the Gita source as we come to it when we begin to explain the caste system. There are two scriptural foundations for the caste, one in the Rig Veda, the other in the Gita. How did the castes come about? Social historians of India believe, with some degree of plausibility, that they were created by the Aryans who settled on Indian soil way back 1,015 to 2,000 years B.C. And what did they do? This admittedly is post-factum speculation, but it has something to say for it. It is believed that in their attempt, and successful attempt, to control the people whom they conquered, they sold them a religion which protected the people who had conquered from being overwhelmed by those whom they had conquered. They therefore set up a theocracy ruled by divinely appointed men who were nothing less than the incarnations of Brahman, whom Zeno calls the Brahman, or more popularly, the Brahmin. They were to be assisted by priests and ministers explaining the laws. Priests who would take care of the ritual, and ministers who would comment on the law and explain Dharma. The top class, therefore, would be the Brahmins. The others, the rulers, would be the Kshatriyas, which would, of course, involve both the military and the priestly and the legal classes. The arms and trade would be handled by another class. Now, the manufacture of arms and the trade in commerce would be the third class. And finally, the aborigines, would be reduced to slavery by the upper three classes. That's one theory of the caste system being originated by the invasion of the Aryans. Another theory, which also is plausible and is certainly verified at least by Sanskrit etymology and by the way in which the thing has worked out over the centuries, that color had a lot to do with the stratification of the castes. The Brahmins were the Sanskrit Brahman, means white or fair colored. His would be the highest duty, such as study, teaching, offering sacrifice, giving gifts and alms. He would be the professional philanthropist, divinely ordained as such. If you've ever read, as I have, a biography of John D. Rockefeller I, there are passages there that read through all the world like authentic Brahminism. He was divinely appointed to lead lesser mortals in their way of life. The second, Vikshatriya, which is a Sanskrit for red or ruddy. Their special privilege is to use weapons, mainly therefore to lead in battle, under always the direction of the Brahmins. The Vaishya, which is a Sanskrit for yellow, their duties are those of trade and commerce. And finally, the Shudra, which is a Sanskrit for black. Their duty, divinely appointed, is to serve the upper three classes. In its heyday, the caste system numbered about 2,500 sub-castes below the principal four. The numbers now are several hundred in a bewildering variety, yet very sensitive to their specific caste privileges. Again, we're still trying to speculate about this caste system because it is so much a part of Hinduism. It has been said, therefore, that the Aryans, or whoever the invaders were, now did not create. See, one theory says they created. Others say they found the caste system. But they superimposed on this caste system the dogma of karma, which is the rule that a person is supposed to obey, by which every man's birth in a caste is the result of previous existence. It is the most complete theological freezing of human stratification known to history. There's nothing like it. Against which, as we shall see when we take up Buddhism, Buddha rebelled. And be it said, as far as he could, also Gandhi, but he never really rose above the caste system. Gandhi never rejected the caste system. Strict observance, therefore, of his caste rules, so for centuries it has been believed, is the only possible hope of eventual liberation, such as there can be, from this wheel of existence. There is a basis for the caste system in the Gita, the passage occurs in the Gita where Krishna, on page 257, Krishna is exhorting Arjuna to be faithful to his duty as a member of the Kshatriya caste. Verses 31 through 34. Likewise, he's given him all kinds of arguments. By the way, the Gita has been going on for some time. But it is, notice, sufficiently at the beginning to indicate that this is one of the primal reasons why Krishna believes that Arjuna ought to enter into battle. Consider thine own task of duty. Thence too hast thou no cause to quail about going into war, for better than a fight prescribed by duty is nothing for a man of the princely class. The princely class should really read Kshatriya caste. Zena, by the way, is very kind. Happy the warriors indeed who become involved in war. That's their duty in life. Nothing else but to fight. A war like this presented by pure chance and opening the gates of paradise. What an opportunity. But if thou wilt now the sanction, if thou wilt not wage this war prescribed by thy task of duty, then by casting off both honor and task of duty, thou wilt bring evil on thyself. Yes, this thy dishonor will become a byword in the mouths of men in ages yet to come, and dishonor that a man well trained to honor is an ill surpassing death. This is worse than death. No stronger motive could a deity use in exhorting a mortal, understanding mortal in Krishna's sense, than to be obedient to his caste. Now, outside of all the castes is the group called the pariahs, which is a Sanskrit for outcast, beyond the caste. A word about each caste. The Brahmins, technically, that is, by scriptural warrant, alone have religious authority. They are not only the interpreters of the Vedas, and indeed, only certain parts of the Vedas are permissible to be read by the lesser caste. And the pariahs are forbidden to read or even to hear the Vedas. And as you may have been reading in the papers, this is going on constantly, except very wisely, India lets us know almost nothing of the race conflict in India, but you may be sure that Detroit is on the front page of every newspaper in the world. At any rate, conflicts have been going on, conflicts to death. As a result, there are riots. Of course, it's not only in temple worship, but other ways in which the pariahs, having been legalized, have been given legal status, which they did not enjoy before Gandhi. At any rate, the Brahmins are the only ones who have religious authority. A phrase they use which summarizes their authority is, the very birth of a Brahmin is a divine incarnation. Whenever a child is born to a Brahmin mother, that is another descent of the god. They are the philosophers, the writers, the leaders, the nobility. The great leaders of India, except for Gandhi. Gandhi did not belong to this caste. But the leaders, those who have the authority, Gandhi had no authority in India, except his own personality. But Nehru and Radhakrishnan, the two greatest names in Indian history, are Brahmins. And the present Prime Minister of India is a Brahmin. No one else but a Brahmin could ever possibly be a Prime Minister. The second Kshatriyas, or the warrior caste, have as their duty to defend what is right, or to defend justice, to protect the weak, and to use force when necessary. By and large, now, they are concentrated in the military segment of Hinduism. There are quite a few, but as you probably know, the Hindus are a very pacifist people. What has actually happened, and this just as an aside, because this is a study all by itself, there is a branch of ex-Hindus called the Sikhs, S-I-K-H-S, who are the warriors for all practical purposes. The fighters in India are the Sikhs. But therein lies a grave problem for India. The Sikhs are clamoring for independence. They want their own country. If that happens, India is lost. Because India has practically no one who even wants to fight. The Kshatriyas have always been a very small segment, too small to protect a nation of almost 500 million. During the wars in which India was involved, the Sikhs were the ones who fought. The military that was manned by the English during their almost two centuries of colonial occupation were the Sikhs. So they have a certain number of policemen and so on belonging to the Kshatriya class. But you don't defend a nation by your police force. And let me say, by the way, that the Marxists understand Hindu theology to the letter. If communist China wanted to, it is said by Indians, 2 weeks would be enough to take over the subcontinent of India.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.